Good afternoon, and I'll call the March 18th meeting of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development to order. And members, we're going to go a little out of order because we have a pretty lengthy informational presentation, so we're going to try to knock out our at least one of our two bills before we go into that. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2540. And Jeremy, could you please tell us about this bill?
House Bill 2540 deals with musicians and unemployment insurance. It repeals the statute designating a person or organization engaging services of musician as employer for purposes of unemployment insurance compensation taxes unless written contract between the parties designates the musician as responsible for required reports and payments. So this measure actually repeals the statute that was enacted in the last session.
And it looks like it has no revenue and no
fiscal impact. Has no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Okay, so we do have a sign-up sheet, and we'll call Ann Koch. Ann Cook, please come forward.
Good afternoon. I'm here.
And could you just please identify yourself for the record?
Hi, I'm Ann Koch.
And maybe push one of those microphones just so it's directed
towards
you. How's
that?
You don't need to be so close.
Okay. But just,
there you go.
So that's
good?
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Ann Cook. I'm an attorney at Machenbacher and Blattner in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here as a result of representing Mississippi Studios, which was a venue that was negatively affected by the statute ORS 657-506. To how I got involved, in addition to representing Mississippi Studios, is Mississippi Studios was audited by the Employment Department, and based on that statute, had to pay employment tax on every musician that has ever performed at Mississippi Studios in the period of the audit, regardless of who the musician was and if there are national and international performing acts. Because of the inequitable result of that audit, some attorneys and I and some industry folks and the Musicians Union formed a committee to look at the law and see what needed to happen to fix the problem. And so I'm here today as a result of looking at the law and why it came into existence and what its purpose is, we came to the conclusion that the simplest approach would be just to repeal that statute. Hopefully Bruce Fife from the Musicians Union will be here today to testify. Great. And he'll speak to you about the broader issue of independent contractor law on musicians and how it's actually a very complex issue, and the question of whether musicians should even be subject to ORS Chapter 657 is another issue, but the reason that we went with the simple approach of repealing 506 is because of the basically inequitable results or inequitable an inconsistent application that has resulted from the existence of this law. So the purpose of this bill is to, one, prevent the inequitable and inconsistent application of independent contractor law to musicians and the people who hire them, and second is to prevent further harm to the industry, whether it's venues, managers and agents of musicians, and some musicians themselves. So turning to the statute itself, and I'm going to address the general independent contractor issue some more, but turning to the statute itself and why it should be repealed, when the audit was initiated by the Employment Department sought the advice of the Attorney General on, in the past they had applied ORS 657-040, which as you might know is the general independent contractor analysis about whether, that would be applied to each musician to look at whether that particular musician qualified as an independent contractor or not. The Attorney General held that solely because of the existence of 506, they didn't need to apply 040, that that the language of that statute was clear. It said, unless there's a contract, one, and then two, unless that contract has the specific language contained in 506, that boom, the musician is the employee of the venue or of the person who hired them, period. And so now what happens is the way the statute is worded is worded that anyone who engages the services of a musician, so it's not just venues, if any performance that exists in the state of Oregon, whether it's a festival, a block party, a wedding, 506 applies. And so unless you have a contract that has the specific wording requirements in that statute, the musician that you hired is deemed your employee and you need to pay unemployment taxes on them. For all other industries, they'll look at independent contractor, they'll apply the independent contractor analysis and look at, the case-by-case situation per musician or per individual. But in this situation, solely with musicians, they do not do this.
And Ms. Cook, I'm going to ask you to just hold your thought for a minute because we've been joined by the chief sponsor of the bill, and it also looks like Bruce Fife is in the audience.
Okay,
so
great.
If you could just hold off for a minute, we're going to ask Representative Shields to come forward and tell us about his bill. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Commerce and Workforce Development Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Chip Shields, a state representative from District 43, Inner North and Northeast Portland. As I'm sure Ann has mentioned, probably gave you the background and the history of the bill. And if there's one thing I've learned in this building, when there's no opposition to the bill, keep your comments brief before you talk somebody out of moving the bill. So I'll just say this was brought to us by Jim Brumberg of Mississippi Studios in my district, and I think this common sense approach to have this revert back to independent contractor law so that that could be applied, because this part of the statute was very unknown to most people and has not been very helpful.
Thank you for your comments. Any questions for Representative Shields? Okay, I think the less is more is actually a very wise approach. So thank you for
thank
being
you,
here
Madam
today.
Chair.
And Bruce, if you wanted to come forward and be part of this panel.
I will keep the rest of my comments brief. So first you're talking about how the 040 is not applied, and so we have some inconsistent application. By repealing 506, it would mean that independent contractor analysis would be applied. So if a venue or anyone who hires a musician is audited, then they would look at, each musician to look at, okay, does this musician qualify as an independent contractor under the statute? The other portions of 506 that are unfortunate, the second portion of that statute says that the person signing the contract on behalf of the band is deemed the employer of the rest of the band. So you have some unintended consequences with that language as well, where you have maybe one representative from the band who signs the contract who now all of a sudden is the employer of the rest of the band, usually unknowingly. But what happens a lot in the current industry practice is that managers and agents are the ones who are involved in the contracting process, not the venues and not the musicians. And so you have agents signing on behalf of the band, you have booking agents and managers, and now they're being deemed the employer of the musical group. And turning again to the current industry practice is, like I said, so often the venues or the people who hire the musicians aren't involved in the contracting process. When you deal with especially the bigger venues, the booking agents send the contracts. More often than not, the booking agents aren't even in Oregon and don't know, that this law even exists. That was the case with Mississippi Studios, where none of the contracts that they had used were Mississippi Studios contracts. They were, different contracts that had been provided from different booking agents around the country. Another piece to this is that because no unemployment claims are filed, the musicians, if Jim, when he testified in front of the House committee, testified as to what musicians he paid unemployment tax on on acts such as Ricky Lee Jones and REM in this audit. And so, you know, those are the kind of people who are not going to be filing for unemployment in the state of Oregon.
Madam Chair, that'd be nice to have them as your employees. You can have them play it any time you want to.
If you had that kind of control over Ricky Lee Jones, I'm sure. And so, you know, the bottom line is that the original intent of this law is no longer being fulfilled. So I guess I'll just close my comments regarding the specific bill, just to point out the overly broad scope. Again, it is worded that it applies to anyone who engages the services of a musician. If we leave this bill intact, performance that exists in the state of Oregon is not only has to have a contract, it has to have the specific wording required by the statute. To expect that every performance that, you know, and any level that happens, you know, and the number of performances that happen in Oregon, that every performance is going to have a contract, I think is somewhat of an unrealistic expectation. Again, I mentioned that Bruce is going to talk generally more about independent contractor law. This repeal, we're here today to just narrowly look at the issue of whether 506 should be repealed. Again, there's the broader issue of musicians and independent contractor law, and, you know, it's a very big issue to get into, and hopefully we can address that, for a future session. But again, to leave this law on the books would continue to cause harm to the industry. There's several venues that are being audited now that are being threatened, you know, essentially with closing because of the, the effect of having every musician being deemed their employer. So to repeal this benefits the industry greatly. Finally, as Representative Shields mentioned, we have no opposition to this bill. We have had an amazing amount of support. I've had people call from all over the state. I've had the owner of Les Schwab Amphitheater call, people from, you know, small little venues in Portland to the biggest venues around. We've had restaurants, various restaurant support, and musicians, and again, managers and agents, because they've been unknowingly kind of pulled into this. And so... we've had a lot of support on this bill.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And I think we'll hold questions till we've heard from both of you. So, Bruce, please go ahead.
Sorry for being late. I was told you wouldn't get to this till 3:30, and so on and so forth. Obviously, Bruce Fife, President, American Federation of Musicians, Local 99. I'm obviously here to speak on behalf of the musicians, and it's important to recognize, and I'm not even sure whether the Employment Department recognizes, how vast and broad the type of business arrangements that exist in the music industry are. You know, on one hand, we have the Oregon Symphony, which is a clear employer-employee relationship, and everything operates just like we all kind of understand. On the other end of the spectrum, you have a club that has said a band can come in and put somebody at the door to collect cover charge, and they play. But there's no real relationship between the club and the band other than they're allowing them to use the space. There's no contract between them. It's a, I don't even know what to call that type. And then there's a myriad of variations in between those two types of business relationships. The business is very different than when this was last amended. 1983 was when this was amended. I was a full-time player at that time. Most of the venues I went into at that time, I would play 4 hours a night, 5 nights a week, 2 weeks at a time, a month at a time, something like that. It was a much different industry, and you could look at that from a standpoint of, does an employer-employee relationship work here, because it was kind of a regular job. That's where this clause was always in the contracts, and it was in the contracts to say, no, regardless, that person is an independent contractor responsible for taxes. Nowadays, it's not uncommon for a band to play less than once a month in a venue if they have a repeat engagement in a venue, and it might be for an hour or two at a time. It's a far different industry than before when this was last amended. There's no doubt that the repeal of this is a positive for the venues, because the responsibility of them to have to pay unemployment taxes is just not the way anybody operates in the nation. I know of no state where a band coming in is not considered to be an independent contractor when it's on a casual basis. Now, I'm not talking about a place where somebody's there 5 nights a week for 2 hours playing piano bar. That's a different situation, but I'm talking about the venues we're talking about where a band is there, where Ricky Lee Jones comes in and plays a concert once a year. They are not deemed anything other than independent contractors everywhere in the nation, as far as I know. In fact, I should point out that Representative Schaffler, we had to inform him that he had violated the law when he hired a band, and the contract he had did not have this language involved in it. So he should have been paying unemployment taxes on that band that he hired for the
I'm sure
band.
He was thrilled to hear that.
He was. Actually, I think he was kind of inspired.
Fortunately, the statute of limitations probably had run.
Probably, yeah, I'm sure.
Protected him, right.
Where the benefit of repealing this is less clear is to the musicians themselves. As Ann was talking about, how we classify musicians, how they come together to work for various situations, bands, is very oftentimes, again, creative. We have one band right now that the band leader is being audited by the OED under this statute, because of they're saying you are the employer of the musicians, because he has not had an individual contract filed with each member of the band for each individual gig. Again, it's something that creates a lot of uncertainty. And what I found when I really got into it after our member got audited is that there's not an attorney, either labor or entertainment, or an accountant that I ran into that can clearly articulate what are the rules. How do I tell our members what the rules are? And nobody can come up with a clear definition of the rules. They're all different as far as who is an employer, who is an independent contractor, how we work those rules. Added to that, that under labor law, the musicians union are unable to organize musicians that work in the clubs because they are deemed by labor law to be independent contractors. We cannot do with them what we do with symphony orchestras, where there is an employer-employee relationship. They are deemed to be independent contractors, so that adds a whole other component to this whole dialogue in the mix. I think mostly I'll stop at this point, too. We certainly support the passage of HB 2540. We think that if nothing else, the musicians and the venues deserve the right to at least make the claim for independent contractor status rather than it being an automatic if there is no contract. I just want to emphasize as much as possible that the time that we are in right now is especially dangerous for our arts organizations and our artists, including musicians. We are the first to feel the crunch of any economic downturn, and believe me, we are hit by it big time. We don't need any more roadblocks in trying to manage our businesses and what goes on, and this is one of those roadblocks. So I'll leave it at that, unless you have any questions.
Okay, are there any questions for these witnesses? Yes, Senator.
I don't have a question. I have a conflict of interest to declare in that I do play the guitar, and occasionally I do play in venues. Most of the time I don't get paid, so I'm not sure what that says about my playing ability. But
it says if there's not a contract, you're an employee.
There you go. Mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about it if I don't get paid. Is there a minimum wage issue I should be claiming?
Anyway. I think we'll have to listen to you play before we decide that.
I'm afraid of that.
An audition. Yes.
Well, we can actually have a senator play because it looks like here that the state is actually exempt from this statute, so we don't have to worry about.
Oh, there we go. There we go.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Yes, Senator Pruszynski.
And I guess I'm going to kind of give a little history myself. When I was in college, I actually did agent work for a pretty good garage band that played regionally in Texas. And so we never had these issues at that time, but I can understand where there could be the unintended consequences. And Bruce, as you've said, changes have occurred as to how the musicians are actually employed or brought into a venue. And my concern, I guess, at this point, it seems to, looking at the vote of 60-0, everyone thinks this was an unintended consequence at this stage, is something that should be changed. You've stated that there are audits ongoing as we speak.
Yes.
And what I notice that this bill does not have is what's known as an emergency clause. And the purpose for emergency clause is to have the bill go into effect upon signing. If it's not signed, or go into effect when it's signed, it would not go into effect until January 1 of 2010, so basically next year. and those individuals that are in the audits right now technically could in fact still be liable under that. So my question to you is that if the committee wanted to move the bill forward to the floor, would you be concerned with us delaying it for a day or two or a work meeting or two to get an emergency clause put into the bill that would require the bill to, after it passed, if it passes here and on the Senate floor, to go back to the House for concurrence?
Yes, please. That would be very helpful to them.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, yes, Senator George.
Based on that, what is the status of people who have already been through the audits? I mean, is this something that can be retroactive? Is this something that can be, because it seems like if they were treated this poorly and if they've lost their case, then we may need to rectify some situations.
Right now, as far as we know, it's just Mississippi Studios, and the amount of the reason we went to the legislature and didn't appeal, go through the court appeals process, it just wasn't, you know, ultimately enough of a tax bill to justify it. I discussed briefly with legislative council adding retroactive language, and we decided to go with the simplest approach that wouldn't cause any, you know, opposition or too much discussion. Mississippi Studios is, you know, they want to see this fixed for future issues, but they're not, you know, it's unfortunate they had to pay the tax on all those musicians, but they're, yeah, they're fine with it, I guess is the best way to put it.
Follow up on that.
I think there are three vet pending cases.
That's what I'm asking.
Cases.
Right, I'm asking to talk about the pending situations,
well,
Madam Chair.
There hasn't been a determination made. My understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's the Aladdin Theater and the Hawthorne Theater in Portland, and then I know
Patrick Lamb
and
Band.
Patrick Lamb, that the Employment Department hasn't made any kind of determination. I assume that if we can add the emergency clause, that they would then be applying the analysis under the current law rather than under 506.
Mm-hmm. And we do have the department signed up to testify, so I think they can answer that question.
And yeah, Madam Chair, I think the record's being set as to what could be our intent. And, you know, it's not, and this is to make certain that, from my perspective, the Employment Department has not done anything wrong. They're enforcing the law that's on the books.
Absolutely. And they're doing what the Attorney General told them.
Right, based on what it is. And the question is, for policy, do we think that's an appropriate policy for us to have, and should it be still pursued at this time?
Okay. Thank you very much.
I should note, just a final note, that, and I forgot to say this, but I want to say it is, you know, if employment insurance is supposed to be a safety net, I can guarantee you there are no musicians operating that may pay in that will ever be able to access this under the current, you know, guidelines. So it just doesn't work for the industry.
No. And Madam Chair, if I could just say, there's a player down in Eugene, Paul Biondi, who's actually with other people set up a network for that safety net, trying to get medical coverage for musicians, because so many of them aren't able to afford it. So I know that there's a lot of networking and cooperative work to try to make certain that those who give us the gift of their music can actually have some stability when they have medical issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thanks again. And we'll call Tom Byerly and Rob Edwards. Good afternoon. Welcome back.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm the administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division of the Employment Department. With me today is Rob Edwards. He's our Unemployment Insurance Tax Manager for the Employment Department. Rob has a few remarks, and then we'd like to try to answer as many questions as we possibly can today. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Rob Edwards, Unemployment Insurance Tax Manager for the Employment Department. Very briefly, I think Ms. Cook actually covered things very well. The repeal of 657-506 will throw us back into doing an independent contractor analysis on these cases. And what we'll be looking at is the relationship between the purported employer or the person making the payment to the purported employee or the musician, and see whether or not that relationship meets the criteria in 657-040 and 7600. Now, questions?
Have to answer any questions.
And I think the question that's arisen would be, what would happen to pending audits that you have going if this bill just went forward and didn't take effect until January?
Madam Chair, if the bill was passed today, for example, the audits that are currently in process, if there are any, due to confidentiality, I can't really talk about it, but if there were any, would be for periods prior to the effective date of the bill, so the audits would proceed.
And if there were an emergency clause, presumably?
Madam Chair, even with an emergency clause, because we're auditing for periods in the past. Right now, the most recent period we would be auditing, I believe, would be fourth quarter of 08. So it would apply to periods fourth quarter of 08 and prior.
Okay. Well, we can take care of that. Now, Madam Chair, I mean, the reality, if the committee wants to actually cover that, as Senator Georgia said, wouldn't be retroactive to those who've already gone through the audit and actually have paid, but we could actually have the effective date that would take in that last quarter. That would give that relief as to what the intent and what I would assume that we will need to make a decision in a work session if and when we go there. I do have a couple of questions if I could.
Yeah, please go ahead.
I wanted to kind of figure this out as to, if 506 goes away, I understand it goes back to an independent contractor perspective. With this unique type of arrangement for musicians, could you walk us through as to, is it the standard eight principles or steps that we have for any independent contractor to determine whether or not they are, in fact, an independent contractor versus an employee?
Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, that's exactly right. It's the criteria found in 670-600, which are basically the eight criteria. Probably the one that we look at the most and give most emphasis to, of course, is direction and control. The person making the payment, how much right of direction and control do they have over the person who's providing the service?
So that's my next question, because I assumed it was going to get to direction and control. We have a venue that says we would like for you to provide your music at this time on these dates, and that's basically it. And the band, at least, usually will have arrangements as to how long they play a set, then they take a break, and stuff like that. If they're giving, if the management's saying, we need your services to play at this point of time on these days, would the department determine that to be sufficient control and to put them into the employee process?
Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, based on that limited amount of information, I would say no.
And since you maybe have seen some of these cases before regarding musicians, can you give us some ballpark of how many times the department has determined a musician to be either an independent contractor or an employee?
Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, since we're applying 506, 657-506.
You're not even getting there.
We're not even getting to independent contractor.
Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, if I could add, that was one of the concerns, right, is because of the way the statutes are constructed. That's why we sought Attorney General advice, because
that's right,
we did not want to do things that we didn't want to go into an unintended consequence, but the law is the law, and so that's where we ended up.
Let me just give you another maybe individual that, let's say, a entertainer, someone like a magician, or somebody that might be putting on some type of a show in a venue. Have you had those type of reviews under the independent contractor?
Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, not that I'm aware of. Please keep in mind that the minimum amount to be subject to unemployment insurance tax is $1,000 a quarter.
Okay.
And I should say that's not per individual, that's per business. So, for example, if you have an individual who's hosting a party or having a wedding, they would need to pay more than $1,000 in a particular calendar quarter before they'd even be subject.
Okay. Thank you all very much.
Okay, any other questions for the department? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2540, and I think we'll do some more research before we take this bill up again.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And because we just have one, I think, a bill with just one witness to testify, we'll try to knock that out, and then we'll go into our public hearing for our informational meeting for the rest of the session. So I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 167. And I think we have a sign-up sheet, but please come forward and tell us, Jeremy, about this bill.
Senate Bill 167 authorizes the Public Employees Benefit Board to allow nurses and nurse educators employed less than half-time for a state agency or university to participate in self-pay group benefit plans without a minimum participation requirement. And the bill has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
It looks like we have Lydia Listman, who's joined us at the witness table. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. For the record, Lydia Listman. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Public Employees Benefit Board, better known as PEB. And I'm here today to request your consideration of Senate Bill 167. This bill makes some technical corrections to Senate Bill 4 enrolled from the previous legislative session in 2007. Senate Bill 4 contained several provisions related to the nursing workforce and nursing faculty shortage. And it added some language to PEB's governing statutes that would allow state-employed nurses or nurse educators who are employed less than half-time to participate in PEB medical and dental benefits by exempting them from the half-time requirements. But what the bill did was actually put the language into the part of the PEB statute that describes who's not eligible to participate in the Public Employees Benefit Board. So what we're doing with Senate Bill 167 is clearly stating that the Benefit Board will allow this group of state employees to access coverage to medical and dental benefits as self-pay participants, even if they don't meet the other requirements that are defined by statute or PEB administrative rule. And self-pay participants are groups of individuals who may enroll in medical and dental benefits in PEB by self-paying the monthly premiums. So the changes under Senate Bill 167 exempt this group of individuals from the requirements related to minimum participation levels for self-pay groups and from the requirements that we have in statute and rule that define half-time employment status as a condition of eligibility. So again, it's a technical correction so that we can implement this benefit.
Thank you for your testimony. And so basically, this is just language to implement what the intent was of the bill that we passed last session then.
Chair Rosenbaum, that is correct. It's to allow us to implement this.
Okay. Are there any questions for this witness? Case. It looks like you've answered them all.
Thank you
very much for being here. And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 167. And members, we have already gotten a statement of no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. It looks like a pretty straightforward bill. So I will open a work session on Senate Bill 167. And Senator Telfer, I see a motion coming on.
Oh, I was yawning. No. Madam Chair, I move that Senate Bill 167 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Senator Telfer has moved Senate Bill 167 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes, Senator Manas Anderson.
Thank you. Senate Bill 4 was my bill and an extremely important bill. As you know, we have a workforce shortage in nursing, but in particularly with nurse educators. And I just wanted to put that on the record that it's an extremely important issue, and we have a long ways to go before we meet the need that Oregon has for nurses and nurse educators.
Thanks for your comment. Pam, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Manas Anderson, would you be so kind as to carry this bill on the floor? Thank you. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 167. And that brings us back to our informational meeting. We have a presentation on skills to compete. And I think do we have a list of people? I think we have two panels of witnesses. If you want to just come forward as you have chosen and the order you've chosen and just tell us first who you are, and then...
I don't have that with me.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
We're known for remodeling.
Oh, great. I think we did that pretty recently here, so...
Okay. Yeah, let's keep them guessing.
good afternoon, and thank you for being so patient, and we're looking forward to your testimony. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the opportunity to appear before you for the record. My name is Greg White. I am the executive staff of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and a member of the Skills to Compete Coalition. I have here the a panel of folks who want to talk to you today. And I have Nan Poppy from Portland Community College and Agnes Balassa from the Workforce Alliance and Chris Latimer from the Oregon Consortium Oregon Workforce Alliance. And they will introduce themselves, I'm sure. But I want to tell you a little bit about the consortium. The Skills to Compete campaign in Oregon formed about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, and we have quite a broad coalition of folks who are kind of the steering committee for the campaign here in Oregon. And that ranges from business groups, the Oregon Business Council, the Associated Oregon Industries, Manufacturing 21, for example, and various state folks like the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, the Governor's Office, Oregon Workforce Investment Board, Community Colleges Association, Portland Community College, Mount Hood, and both Work Systems, Inc. and the Oregon Workforce Alliance, Oregon Consortium, as local board members, and then, of course, the Oregon Workforce Alliance, or rather the Workforce Alliance at the national level. Not the Oregon. I guess I have to put an O in front of everything. The goal of the coalition today is just to bring you some information to you as policymakers about the importance and Oregon's economy's dependence on those jobs that require more than a high school diploma but less than a four-year degree, which we're calling the forgotten middle-skill jobs. And these 52% of all the jobs in Oregon's labor market are these kinds of jobs. And so they are really the backbone of Oregon's middle class, and that's their importance to the state. Goals of the campaign, and you'll see the data in the report that you've been presented, really align with the governor's and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board's goals and priorities, like 40-40-20. We are talking about the middle 40 here. The whole education enterprise, efforts to implement the career readiness certificate, OWIB strategic plan, winning in the global market with its concentration on high-skill, high-wage jobs, expansion of career technical education, and all of these policy directions, which just fit extremely well into the Skills to Compete campaign and report here in Oregon. Now, I'd like to turn it over to Agnes Balassa, who will talk to you a little bit about the findings and implications from the report.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I'm hoping each one of you has in front of you a blue folder, and on the left-hand side behind my testimony is a copy of the report that we are sharing with you. I'm Agnes Balassa, the Regional Field Director for the Workforce Alliance. The Workforce Alliance is a national, nonpartisan organization, privately funded. We are a coalition of business and industry, labor, education, training, and publicly funded organizations, all with a focus on increasing the skill development of the American population. As the regional field director, I provide workforce development technical assistance, policy analysis, and support to organizations in 9 western states, including Oregon. However, I actually live here in Salem, Oregon, and spent the last 10 years working as a local investment board director, so I'm very familiar with Oregon's economic development and workforce issues. I'd like to start by thanking you all for your commitment to addressing the urgent workforce development needs of the Oregonians who deserve quality opportunities that Oregon companies would like to provide. The Workforce Alliance is the convener at the national level of a Skills to Compete campaign, and we are supporting the Oregon campaign, which is why I'm here today to provide you with some information. Several times in our nation's history, visionary leaders have taken bold steps to align education and workforce policy with economic realities. If you go back to the 1920s and the alignment of the promise of high school education to every person in the United States with the needs of the companies at that time, you see what fueled the Industrial Revolution in terms of human power. In the 1950s and 60s, the GI Bill matched the needs of the industrial complex that was forming and fueled our economy for over 50 years, leading us to be one of the strongest nations in the world. Today we're facing a new economic reality, and bold responses are required once again, and that's what we'd like to talk to you about. There's a myth that we are rapidly moving towards an economy that often is called an hourglass economy, one with a relatively small number of highly skilled, highly paid jobs at the top that require 4 years of education plus, and many, many more low-skilled, dead-end, low-wage jobs at the bottom. The research that we've done shows that that's just not true, and that, in fact, this myth that there's a dying middle class doesn't exist, but what we need to do is to figure out how to support that middle class more effectively with our policy and resource investments. And that's really the point of the Oregon Skills to Compete campaign. Our report is called Oregon's Forgotten Middle-Skilled Jobs. We call them forgotten because these are the jobs that often you don't hear people talking about. They're not necessarily the ones that parents, high school counselors, and we as a public as a whole talk about, yet these are the jobs that make up 52% of our economy and therefore are the single largest sector of our economy. The facts are that even though we call these middle-skilled jobs, that we're really only referring to the educational levels required for them, more than a high school diploma, but not necessarily a four-year degree. But most of these jobs are highly technical. Many have career paths that lead to upper wages. Many are unionized. Many are well-paid. And because many of them are hands-on, they're not easy to outsource. Your local electricians, your firemen, your auto mechanics, these are not jobs that you can easily send to other countries. So they tend to be stable. And they account for 900,000 jobs in our Oregon economy. The fact is that we see about 340,000 of these jobs projected to be open in the next 10 years. That's twice as many as you have in that very high skill category and twice as many as you have in that low skill, needing no requirements beyond the high school diploma category. The fact is these middle skill jobs exist in every sector of our economy, so it's a broad-based approach, not just focusing on any one specific industry. They range from healthcare to manufacturing to the skilled trades to finance to transportation. And a report actually provides a list of the jobs with wages as well as projections for growth, I believe on page 9. The median wages for many of these jobs exist Oregon's median wage of $31,000 per year. And Oregon does not have enough workers to fill these jobs currently. In fact, in 2004, just going backwards in the data a little bit, out of the 52% of the jobs that these make up in our economy, we only had about 47% of Oregonians skilled to this level. In 2007, the number was down to 46%, so we're starting to see a downward trend. That will potentially accelerate as more and more highly skilled workers will continue to retire. The fact is that this gap between supply and demand cannot be met solely by focusing on graduating high school students. Two-thirds of the workers that we will have in our economy in 2020 are already working. Yet most public policy conversations and most investments focus on those people less than 25 years old who are just out of high school. And the fact is that most of the green jobs in our economy, as we talk about green jobs fueling Oregon's future, most of those green jobs are also middle-skilled jobs. In fact, our research showed that about 66% of the employment in energy efficiency, 71% in wind technology, and 56% in biofuels require more than a high school diploma, but not necessarily a four-year degree. The fact is that people trained to this level remains high and is more and more difficult to fill as we have fewer programs in place to be able to serve this need. We know that not all the information in front of you is probably news to you. There's probably a lot of this that sounds familiar as you've heard businesses and others come in front of you to talk about needs. But really, what's important and why we're here today is to talk about what to do with this kind of data and information. For us, our answer seems pretty simple. We believe that there's a tendency to focus on the 30% of jobs at the top and the 20% jobs at the bottom, and we recommend a focus also on the 50% in the middle. We don't dispute the fact that a high school diploma is absolutely essential for every Oregonian to have. In fact, we encourage that and support that. Yet it's not enough to compete for 50% of the jobs in our economy. We also believe a strategy needs to include a focus on higher education beyond those 2 years, yet it can't be the sole focus of an economic development policy when there are so many jobs in the middle. So we're asking you for three things. We're asking you to focus on the middle 52, the jobs that are going unfilled because we do not have enough people sufficiently trained for them, This is why we appreciate the governor's 40-40-20 plan, because at least he's talking about that middle group in this plan. We feel the best way to meet the demand for these jobs is a guarantee of access to the equivalent of at least 2 years of education and training beyond high school, leading to a career technical certificate, industrial certification, or one of the first 2 years of colleges, to be pursued at whenever somebody is ready, at whatever pace makes sense to individuals in industry. But we realize this is a lofty and long-term goal, and even with the visionary and highly skilled leadership we have in Oregon, this is not something that would be accomplished immediately. This is a long, long-term goal. Still, each legislative session provides opportunities to put steps in place to move towards the goal, and you have the ability to affect policy and funding resources related to training, education, financial aid, systems capacity, improved assessment and remediation, social supports for adults while in training, including child care and scholarships, mechanisms to help those collecting unemployment insurance access training more effectively, and incentives for greater public and private partnerships, which we feel are key for meeting the demand in these jobs. We ask that you make use of the panelists that we brought here today on this panel and the second panel as resources. They're highly knowledgeable and happy to respond to any questions you may have outside of this hearing today. And we also ask that you use the information we're providing today as you make your decisions about education, training, policy, and investments. If Oregon's to recover from this economy stronger and better positioned, it's important that we focus on the single largest sector of our employment market, the 52% of jobs that require more than a high school diploma, yet less than a four-year degree. We ask that you keep this in mind as you evaluate all of the options in front of you and as you move forward with your deliberations. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. And with that, I'd like to pass this over to Nan Poppe.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Nan Poppe, and I'm a campus president from Portland Community College. Community colleges across the country, as well as all 17 community colleges in Oregon, are enthusiastic supporters of the Skills to Compete campaign. That's because from where we sit, we are acutely aware that the bar really has been raised, and a high school diploma just isn't enough to ensure a family wage job. It's especially disconcerting when you look at Oregon's demographics to see that our college-going rates are going in the wrong direction. And when you look at our demographics and you see that our Latino population is the fastest growing, yet has the lowest rate of college post-secondary attainment, it looks like a train wreck. So this Skills to Compete campaign gives us an opportunity to bring it to Oregon to, number one, just to raise awareness. The fact of the matter that to get a good job, you are going to need more than a high school diploma. Secondly, it's an opportunity to begin to look at how we can increase more, to get more opportunities for apprenticeships, certificate and degree programs at community colleges, industry vendor certifications, and public-private partnerships that can provide these opportunities for ongoing skill training. I think the public policy, as Agnes was alluding to, is that if high school isn't enough, and our country was founded on providing 12 years of public education to every citizen, how do we then begin to think about extending that and providing that 2 years of post-secondary over your lifetime so you can continue to have your skills upgraded? Certainly, these are difficult times across the nation, and you are sitting in very tough places with difficult decisions before you this session. But I hope as you make those very tough decisions that you will use this report and start to lay the framework of how we can get more and more Oregonians post-secondary so they can move into these jobs. Because it's not just focusing on K-12 and having a seamless pathway for those young people to get that. But I would just remind you that we have over 400 Oregonians that don't have high school credentials that are adults, and it's 400,000. So we need to begin to think of remediation also. You know, at the community college every day, especially now, we're faced with people coming in who really want to become nurses, auto mechanics, diesel mechanics, and they don't have the college-level skills to be able to immediately start in those courses, and they need remediation. So that's going to be a big chunk of this, too. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, Committee. Thanks for having me this afternoon. My name is Chris Latimer, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Consortium and Oregon Workforce Alliance. And we are the local Workforce Investment Board responsible for the delivery of Workforce Investment Act and WorkSource Oregon services across rural Oregon. So everything east of the Cascades and most of the coastal counties are under our jurisdiction. And so if my voice will hold out with me, I'll talk with you a little about the skills to compete and our perspective from rural Oregon, because it is a little, it varies a little bit from the general perspective. And can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Just about a year ago, the Oregon Consortium Board of Directors and their partner, the Oregon Workforce Alliance, the local workforce investment board for the 24-county area, adopted a new vision. And this was before we got involved with the Skills to Compete campaign, before my good friend Agnes went over to TWA and left all of us LWIB directors here in Oregon. But our vision for 2012, after talking long and hard about what can we do to make a change in our rural communities, because this economic crisis was on the horizon. We could feel it. It wasn't here yet. It wasn't real. But we need to do something. Something's got to change in rural Oregon, or we're going to be overseeing ghost towns. And I don't want to leave ghost towns in rural Oregon as my legacy, having been the director of this 24-county organization. So our vision for 2012 is to be the driving force behind an evolution in attitudes and behavior that embraces the need to skill up, ultimately revolutionizing our rural economies. And if only we had embraced that vision, maybe 5 years ago. Of course, that was before I took over as the director. So, they couldn't have known. The economic crisis that Oregon, the nation, and the world is experiencing has hit rural Oregon like a tsunami. I was looking at, of course, unemployment rates recently. And as you all know, the new unemployment rate for Oregon was announced yesterday at 10.8%. Well, in January, Oregon's unemployment rate was 9.8%. The most recent county data that I can pull still is for January, and that was 13% on average for the 24 counties that I serve. In those 24 counties, though, in January, I had counties like Harney County that were already at 19.57%. Now, that was before Monaco shut down. That was before Fleetwood shut down. When those industries closed their doors, Fleetwood, Monaco, Bayliner, they closed their doors for good. Those industries aren't coming back. So we've got to do something different in our rural communities, and we've got to figure out how we're going to bring business and industry back into rural Oregon. In order for us to recover and once again be a vibrant place where citizens can choose to live happily and well, we have to see our vision for 2012 through to fruition, right? Or to fruition. I always throw that through in. I don't need it to. And that means developing our human capital by assuring that all of our citizens possess the skills needed to work in and support the business and industries of tomorrow. From my perspective, I have counties that are going to recover. Like, we do serve Deschutes County. They're going to recover. They have Cessna. They have industries like that that are going to come back. They're going to grow again. But in these other counties, I've got to do and find something different and new. And what we're going to have to do is really increase our middle skill levels. When you look at statistics across rural Oregon, you'll see that many of our counties, our high school graduation rates really are great. But then once we leave high school, we start to decline. We don't have the numbers of associate's degrees, bachelor's degrees, or master's degrees, or any degrees beyond high school that the urban areas have. The Skills to Compete campaign is focused on those skills that can move or keep a family out of poverty and connect them to the living wage of the future and keep them in rural Oregon. So I brought a few examples of what I mean by that and things that are already occurring out in rural Oregon. Take Todd, for instance. He's 52-year-old, and he's been working in the timber industry all of his life. He was a saw filer. That's a good job over there in eastern Oregon. But he could see the writing on the wall. He knew that his job was going to be eliminated. So Todd started researching professions with assistance from our provider in Umatilla County, CAPCO is the name of the organization there, and working with BMCC, and he found out that Blue Mountain Community College was going to restart their diesel fuel technician program, and he's enrolled in that program. He's got a work experience going at the local Caterpillar dealer, and he'll find work. He has a skill now that he can take to industry. Caterpillar's doing okay. I heard some information on that on NPR yesterday, so that's good. Samantha is another example. She's enrolled in one of our programs over in Eastern Oregon. She's 21 years old. She came to the program, a 21-year-old with only 3 months of work experience in her life. And it was a menial, you know, basic job working at McDonald's. And she wants to be self-sufficient. She wants to, you know, prosper in Eastern Oregon. She got her basic skill levels up, which she needed. She then was able to get some computer skills, some office skills, and now has secured a job as a bank teller. So she's moved up, and a bank teller is a great job because there's a good career pathway in the banking industry. I'm going to skip Grant because I think we're probably running a little long on our information here. But just to make the point, Grant left the timber industry also. He was able to get his CDL, get a hazmat endorsement, and now has been hired as a truck driver, and transportation is also a big industry still in Eastern Oregon, and it will continue to be. There are a plethora of stories like these across rural Oregon, and there needs to be more stories like this. We can't do it all with the funding that we receive in the Workforce Investment Act. Community colleges can't do it all on their own, and the public education system obviously can't do it. And we can't save rural communities by simply putting everyone into truck driving school, and we realize that too. So if you asked me today what the jobs of tomorrow are that will save a community like Burns, I'm going to answer you honestly, and I told Judge Grassley on the telephone, because he's my boss, and I told him yesterday, I don't know what it is, Steve. I don't know what the answer is, but I can tell you I don't want your people to leave that community. I want to give them hope, and if giving them middle skills gives us the ability to say to the world, hey, look at rural Oregon. We have a workforce ready to hire. Come look at our community. That's what we're going to do. So, you know, we're fully supporting Oregon's Skill to Compete campaign. And, you know, what I'm asking of you is that, you know, just like Nan said, as you're examining workforce and education policies over this session and the next session and in the future, we hope that you'll use the information that we're providing you today as a filter as you make decisions to think about how we're going to impact those folks that need those middle skills. Thank you.
Thank you all for your testimony. Are there any questions for these panelists? Yes, Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I wanted to find out if you've taken your message to the House side, and the reason I ask is Representative Hovey, since he's been part of the members of the legislature, he has been very active in trying to get the apprenticeship programs running. Mm-hmm. He's visualized, as you've said, as to this skill set that we need to have for us to be able to compete. So has this been presented on the House side?
Chair Rosenbaum and Senator Przanski, we did a presentation for them just last Thursday in front of the House Business and Labor Subcommittee on Workforce Great. Development.
Great.
So I guess I wanted to ask you, looking at the numbers of these jobs, with a few exceptions like registered nurses, really, the numbers aren't hugely different than the numbers of people we have in these occupations now. So is the need that, I mean, do we have training programs in place but just not enough slots in them to actually accommodate, or is this a question of getting high school kids to start focusing on these jobs at an earlier age? I know we're not doing really well in terms of technical education at the high school level either. What do you think is the biggest focus we need to have?
Chair Rosenbaum, I think Nan Poppy may want to help with the answer on this one, but I think the answer so far is all of the above. That, yes, there is some capacity lost, and especially there's capacity loss when you don't have people demanding these kinds of training. So you hit it on the head in terms of part of the equation being the fact that people don't know about the opportunities provided in these careers and aren't necessarily preparing for them, therefore reducing demand, which leaves colleges in a position to not be able to run programs at some point. I'm going to let Nan talk a little bit more about
Yeah, I'll just echo that and say, you know, the other thing is that because of technology, the labor market is changing so fast that people need to continue to skill up. And so, especially as we see this new green, getting programs like solar voltaic technician up and running are going to be that kind of technician level is going to be really, really important. And to go into those, people are going to have to come in with solid basic skills.
And if I may add one other thing, that you know, part of the challenge is here. Our research shows that for 52% of the jobs, you've got about 46% of the people trained for those. That's a very broad generalization. When you get into finer detail there, what you'll find is just because somebody has a certificate or a two-year degree doesn't mean it's for necessarily the job that's in demand at this moment. So it really does require continual skilling up and continual retraining.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. I think we have another panel coming forward, so please make way.
Strength, because the training isn't anywhere.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for waiting so patiently through our other business.
Okay. Thank you for having us. I'm Johnny George from Climax Portable Machine Tools in Newburgh, Oregon. And Climax Portable Machine Tools has been in business for over 40 years, and we build and manufacture portable machine tools that is used all over the world. And we have standard products as well as products that have never been built before and will never be built again. These are one-off unique solutions that are used in all different types of industry, including the green energy that you're talking about right now that you're trying to attract to Oregon. And we've also talked about, and we've heard other people talk about, the need for the skilled workers and what type of environment does that skilled worker come from. And I'd like to give you a couple examples, and I've brought some real-life examples with me. I've got two of my colleagues here, Nathan Short and Don Carruthers, who have both been through a different type of an educational environment to get them where they are today, and I'd like for them to share that with you. I also have an example of another person in our organization that started out as a work-study student when they were a junior in high school. And through that type of an environment and through that type of a skills-building program, that person was able to be a work-study student working in conjunction with business and then getting skilled up for a better position within a company somewhere during their career through a different career path. And that person is me. I started as that high school student when I was 17 years old, and I am now the vice president of our organization at an executive level and the chief cultural officer for our company. And my stand for our company as the chief cultural officer is to create an environment where passionate ambassadors can create possibilities. And the two gentlemen that are here with me today are part of those possibilities, and they continue to share that possibility by giving back to the community. We do need those skilled employees coming to us. And not everyone that joins our organization starts out with a two-year degree or even a four-year degree, but we have an absolutely wonderful career path for people that join us. They can come in and they can start as a machinist or an assembler. They can then go on to go into our purchasing area. They can go on into engineering. They can go into sales. They can go into our leadership team. They can go into human resources. But the technical skills that they bring to us, that they learn in school, that brings them to us, is what we need to fuel our company. And our company is a direct provider of repair equipment and trainers of that equipment for those types of industries that we want to bring into Oregon and that are also represented all over the world. We sell to Fortune 100 companies, and our employees train their employees because they can't find people that are trained to do this either. And so we use our employees to do that. We offer, as an employer, to help with this. We offer 100% tuition assistance to our employees along with fully paid books to go along with that. We count on the community colleges. We count on the high schools. to bring us those types of people. And you had asked earlier if we need to focus more on high school to get that. I believe that high school is too late to start the kids to focus in this type of an industry. By the time they're in high school, they already have to choose the types of math and sciences and those kinds of careers that they might be interested in that feed into the community college that then bring us these kinds of great employees. So we have taken it upon ourselves as business to start an internship program that we are doing in the community, and we need to continue to get help for those kinds of programs and also continue to get the funding for things that come out of, like, the workforce development group or the consortiums, because those help us train employees, multiple employees. In fact, our whole workforce by those types of programs. So we can train, 125 employees out of programs that come through these consortiums and these workforce development plans. And we have been doing that, and we have been taking advantage of that. So I really ask that you continue to do those. They help fuel our organization. They help fuel our growth, which in turn keeps manufacturing in Oregon, because Climax is bucking the system when it comes to manufacturing. We ship outside of the United States to other countries, and we want to continue to do that, and I need a good skilled workforce in order to make that happen. So I'd like to turn it over to Don and Nathan and let them share their story.
Great. Thank you.
You bet.
My name is Don Carruthers. I joined Climax 12 years ago. I came right out of high school. I was doing things I liked, wood shop, welding, machining. I thought it was more of a hobby than a career path. Climax offered me a scholarship right out of high school. I greatly took advantage of it. I went to Chemeketa and earned an associate's degree in manufacturing engineering. At the same time, I had a daughter my second year going to the community college, which kind of split my time up where I had to finish my last year over 2 years. But I was still able to work in the evenings, go to school in the mornings. Climax has just been great to us. They always offer training, trying to find people that come to our workplace. New employees don't really have the skills that we look for, but we look for people that are knowledgeable in the mechanic type industry and things that we can teach them. All of us go through skills training at work, creative thinking, all kinds of setup production training that really helps us on the job, and we apply those to the new people that come in and join us. So I think it's been great working at Climax. We see a lot of people. We work in different industries all the time. We design new machines for all different types of industries, power generation and shipbuilding. It's brought my career path so far. I'm the lead man out in the shop now. I led the night shift for 5 years, and I've been leading the day shift now for 2 years. So, thank you.
Great. Thank you for your comments. Please go ahead.
All right. My name's Nathan Short, and it just kind of hit me as a wow moment here that I'm actually, wow. Don't be.
Yeah, really.
Man, that's, because the only time I'm used to going to a courthouse is to visit my uncles in jail.
This isn't that different.
Got away with,
he's got a gavel, but I don't think he'll use it that way.
But, so my whole story is getting jumbled up because it's, wow, it's so exciting being actually talking here. But, I'll start out. Freshman in high school, I took an assessment test, and they said, well, your strongest skill sets are either a policeman or a machinist. Well, I wasn't always the best student, and kind of went through high school. I took a lot of shop classes, agriculture, horticulture, all those kind of classes. And the instructor told me, well, we got this manual lathe, just this old wood or a metal turning lathe in the corner that they'd had for like 15 years but never hooked it up. Well, it took me a little over three years. For the last 6 months of my high school, I talked him into coming in and plugging this thing in. And then it just seemed like, well, it was over. I was kind of, really enjoyed it. But high school is over, and I kind of had that I thought I knew it better thing. So, I'm just going to take a year off and go to work kind of thing. Well, I got on at a landfill in Arlington, Oregon. And I worked there for 7 years. And I really hated my job. You know, it just kept getting worse and worse. And you see a few industrial accidents, and then it's like, man, you know. And I have a wife and 5 kids. And one day I just figured that, you know, I better go do something before I end up one of these guys that are mashed or something, you know. Because every day I got up and I run equipment there, and I had to work at it to be good at it. You know, some people were natural at it, and I just had a bad attitude anyway because I just hated my job. But I remembered the assessment that I had taken when I was a freshman, and the counselor there told me about this school in Yakima. It's Perry Technical. I said, well, they're supposed to have one of the best machine programs in the Northwest. Well, so I called up and I run up there and I took their test and you know, pretty nervous about giving up a job you're already trapped into to go into something to get training. Well, I failed the entrance exam by 2 points. Oh man, so you know, I drug myself in there, asked the instructor if, well, you know, you think you could kind of sign me off on this, because I really kind of wanted to try it out, remember, and I was, how much I liked it in school. Well, he said, well, if you're a straight A student, I'll sign you on for one term. And it's just been wonderful ever since. You know, geometry, trigonometry, and I never even made it through pre-al in high school. But everything just clicked, you know. And from there, I worked local shops in Yakima, moved to Wyoming, worked in the service field for a while there. And it's just wonderful to wake up and want to go to work, you know. And just remember my dad worked for the railroad, and he always just hated getting up and going. He'd call and he'd be just, you know, and I just seen myself that way, you know. So I think it's really important to put it out there more and get people on there. I mean, now I'm on the advisory board for my old school. I've just started teaching at Chemeketa now for machining, and I graduated high school with a modified diploma of 1.73 grade point average, and it was, it's just really nice. Now that I'm talking to you guys, I mean, this is, my heart's going about a million miles an hour. It's just, I don't know, it's a really big deal to me. It's a milestone in my career here, I guess, being able to just say I've been here. It's like, wow. Neat. It's really neat. Oh, yeah. And I also run the shop on the weekends there. I'm the weekend foreman and oversee, you know, work orders and keep track of utilization and stuff like that. It's neat. Hopefully it just keeps going up for me, because I found out about 2 hours I was going to be here, and I'm like, I ran over and put a shirt under here, and I'm like, oh man, you know, it's neat.
Thank you, Nathan. Thanks very much for telling your story. And the program that you got into in Yakima, was it a community college program or was it a private?
It's actually a private school.
Uh-huh.
And I worked with the school, I worked an after-school job and everything to be able to get through it, and it was pretty tough, you know. And then my wife stayed in Arlington and worked full time. She was bartender and waitress with the kids, you know, because she had family there, and it helped us through. And it wasn't very easy at all. I mean, it was a couple times I just about left school to go home, but I stuck it out, and I'm really glad I did.
Sounds like it really, you know, has paid off for you and for the company. So.
Yeah, I get up, and it's like, I get to go to work.
Okay, well, thanks. Thanks a lot for sharing your story. Ann?
Chair Rosenbaum, and members of the committee. I'm Jim Azumano. I'm the director of the Education Research Institute of the Northwest Food Processors, and I'm just really inspired also by Nathan and Don here, because they're the kind of people that we're here to represent and to talk about. We just don't have enough of them. As you probably know, over 25% of the land in Oregon is devoted to agriculture, and a lot of that is sold as commodities across the world, but really the value-added benefit for Oregon is in food processing. And so you have about 185 food processors in the state, and they produce about $508 million to your income tax system that funds the state. And everyone eats every day, so they kind of take the food industry for granted, I think. But food really is the bridge between urban and rural interdependence, and I think we forget about that when we focus on the differences and the divide. But food is the bridge. And most of our 22,500 jobs in Oregon are these middle skill jobs, and they require more than a high school education, less than a four-year degree. For example, Perry Technical is also one of the people that we work with in developing a survey of all the Oregon food processors to look at what skills do we really need for this operation, and it's basic pipe fitting, basic welding, boiler operation, electricity, energy auditing, hydraulics, industrial refrigeration, machine technology, lubrication, welding, cutting, things of that nature. So most all of mechanical aptitudes. And maybe these are taken for granted because they're not as popular politically, so our schools really don't teach them as much. So consequently, I think we're all looking at a struggle for survival in this kind of an economy. So prior to the economic downturn, the Oregon Department of Employment projected an increase in job demand in the state at 14.1% growth for the decade starting 2006 and ending 2016. And despite the changes maybe in our growth projections, for every job that's been projected for growth, really two jobs are estimated and projected for replacement jobs for people that are retiring. And so, you know, some of the people's retirement schedules are probably changing now because of different things in the economy, but nonetheless, they're still planning to retire. If you go to any production facility, the break room is still, there's more and more people talking about retirement because more of them are in their 40s and 50s. 42% of Oregon's workforce is age 45 and older, and food processors are certainly no exception to that. And they have no current strategy, no current workforce system to really replace the number of workers at the rate that are projected to retire. At a recent meeting of 16 of our executive board members, I asked for a show of hands to see how many of the food processors had a retirement schedule database or had even asked the question or explored the question. Only two of 16 of the largest companies raised their hands. And so out of those two, I thought I'd be able to teach the other 14 about it, and I asked them, what did you do with your data? What strategies are you coming out with from a management point of view? And they are frightened. They don't have a strategy because they're looking at the majority of their employees turning over. And so some of them are saying that maybe on an average 45% of the employees in some of their production lines are going to turn over. But in some production lines, they all came in at the same time, they all stayed forever, and they're all leaving at the same time. So they have nobody to replace those people. And so another State of Oregon study, it was in an article published last May by Brenda Turner of WorkSource Oregon, and she identified 13 of Oregon's industries in which manufacturing is challenged with replacing 9 out of 10 workers in that same decade from 2006 to 2016. So this skills to compete program is really one of the most important things that is going to help us to retain food processors in Oregon. In our coffee, or in our water cooler discussions with some of the execs, we know some of them have no choice but to look at contingency plans at other states that have workforce programs that can supply the people. And we've lost a couple in the last several years, and we may lose some more in the future. The food processing industry right now is in good shape. We've added 1,000 jobs in 2008, but we know 2009 is going to be dramatically different. And so as policymakers, we just want you to be very aware that you can no longer assume that just because we harvest the food and the agriculture in Oregon doesn't mean that we're going to be able to continue processing it here. It's going to take a workforce. And so we're not giving up on Oregon. The Northwest Food Processors are making partnerships with community colleges. We've established some new pilot programs, a model program down in Albany with it's called a mechatronics program with Lynn Benton Community College. Two of the large food processors down there, Oregon Freeze Dried and National Frozen Foods. The Albany School Districts have merged together to create a mechatronics program, funded the money to put in the equipment, and enrollment has exceeded the capacity of the class in the first registration. So they have 18 seats, but we're needing probably a couple thousand graduates a year in this next decade. So even though we're figuring out different ways to do it, we just don't have the capacity. So we're providing an opportunity for family wage jobs at, you know, mostly $23 an hour, and many of our companies, and I think you already know this, but it's cheaper and easier to retain companies in Oregon than it is to recruit them and create new jobs and new companies. So I'm kind of preaching to the choir there, I'm sure. But the food processors want you to know that the middle-skilled jobs are the backbone of the Oregon manufacturing industry. In our industry, it's 80-85%, sometimes even 90% of a workforce in a food processing company if the corporate headquarters is out of state. Some of our companies in Oregon have 7 or 8 plants in other states. And so we know we're in a competition to sustain the ones in Oregon and keep them here. And I provided you with some copies that confirm the state data so that you can see that the manufacturing of all the 13 industrial clusters is one of the ones that's going to be facing the most important challenges. And I wanted to also comment, if I may, on Chris's comment about rural and urban, that when a food processor, another way that things are different between rural and urban Oregon when it comes to a food processor, if a food processor is one of the largest employers in a rural community, and that food processor fades away and goes to a different county or state, they're one of the few employers that's probably paying the best benefits in the community. And so consequently, if we lose those food processors, we put the local rural clinics and hospitals at risk, and we also put the schools at risk at the same time. So when she spoke about a ghost town, it really starts with a key employer, whether it's forestry or food or manufacturing of any sort. So with that, thank you very much for indulging me.
Thank you very much for your excellent testimony. Do we have any questions for this panel? Okay. Well, thank you very much for
thank you all very much for coming forward.
Yes. And I think, members, Senator Przanski, we did vote on a bill while you were out of the room, so the chair will ask for the rules to be suspended for the purpose of allowing Senator Przanski to vote on Senate Bill 167. Is there any objection? Hearing none, Senator Przanski, how do you vote?
Aye.
He votes aye. And members, with nothing further to come before us, we are adjourned. Yeah.